This is Hashtag History, episode 139. I'm Rachel.
And I'm Leah.
Jeez. I'm tired.
Yeah.
Boy, this particular episode is a long time coming.
I'm so excited for this one.
I'm so
glad. For many reasons.
Yay! Is it because of this drink that's in front of us?
That's one of them. And the other one is the topic. I feel like you've talked about wanting to talk about maybe Eleanor specifically, but
yeah.
Sorry, I don't want to jump the gun here.
No, you're welcome to jump the gun. It's presidential adjacent history, which is kind of like my favorite.
Yeah.
But also, I'm going to talk as fast as I freaking can because we just spent 10 minutes off air talking about how delicious this drink looks.
Oh, God. Yeah. Talk fast.
Watch. Here we go.
Do we really need an intro? Like,
we
honestly?
We don't even need one. Ding, ding. I have been wanting to cover this topic probably since we started this podcast, which was almost 5 years ago now.
Yeah.
This is also almost the end of yet another season of the podcast, which means that we have an exciting announcement at the end of this episode about our special guests that will be joining us next week for our season finale. And we know you all are going to love this one.
Mm-hmm.
But back to this week's topic, because I can hardly wait to dive into it. Oftentimes, because I am such a history nerd, I don't know when things are common knowledge and when they're not. Do you know what I mean?
Yes.
Like, it's things like everyone knows that Abraham Lincoln was the first president to not be born in the original 13 states, right? Like, but like, does everyone know that? Or is that just me because I consume too much of this content?
I think that's mostly just you, but I'm sure there is a very large population. There's probably dozens of you who exist.
Only dozens.
There's
within
dozens
the state
of
California. That's how I feel about this week's episode. So I'm going to need you to give me the reality check, Leah. Does everyone already know what we are discussing in this week's episode? Or is this just one of those things that I've consumed too much about? And so now my perception of reality is skewed.
I think that it is, your perception is skewed.
Okay. Well, that honestly, that makes me feel better because I feel like I'm like, to me, mm-hmm. this feels like I'm telling everyone like the history of the Civil War.
Yeah.
Although, let's be honest.
Most people don't.
A lot of people don't know.
Yeah. It almost feels like you're reading them their grocery list or, you know, something that they already know. But no, I can assure you that you are going to teach me and all of our audience something.
I can't tell you the relief I just felt when you said that.
Okay.
Because this week, we will be discussing the relationship between husband and wife, president and first lady, Franklin and Eleanor Roosevelt.
Oh, yeah, we are.
I think it's common knowledge, right? Am I going to say that 100 times? That this married couple were actually cousins? Yeah? Was that common knowledge?
I did know that one. Okay. Yes.
But is it also common knowledge that Franklin Roosevelt was rumored to have had a number of affairs, right?
Mm-hmm.
And that Eleanor perhaps had her own affair with a woman.
Intrigue.
If this is something that is common knowledge, listeners, please let us know in our Instagram DMs. But even if it is, I am confident there will be something in this episode that you did not already know, mm-hmm. as there was so much that I learned in my own research for this episode.
So exciting.
I'm so excited. But what I'm even more excited than talking about the juicy
cousin loving details.
This cousin loving details is this drink that's in front of us. So let's try out what is our last cocktail of the season.
Oh.
Ding, da, da, ding, da, da, ding.
Okay.
I'm Rachel.
And I'm Leah.
And this is Hashtag History,
the podcast for both history nerds and history haters alike,
where we dive into history's greatest stories of controversy, conspiracy, and corruption.
This week's cocktail was brought to us by none other than Janine.
Oh, Janine.
Is this our Janine?
This is our Janine.
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 Yeah, so Janine, who is a dear, dear friend of ours, bought us this week's cocktail. And she left us a message saying, no shout out necessary, just proud of you two with a heart.
Stop.
Well, I wholeheartedly disagree and do think a shout out is necessary.
Always. So. It's in our contract. Yeah. We literally physically have to give you shout outs when you give us money for drinks.
But also because you're the absolute best and yes. We love you.
Yes.
So.
Thank you so much, Janine. That was so sweet. And my eyes are now watery.
Yeah. Take it. Take our love.
Yes.
This week's cocktail idea was originally going to be straight up stolen from our friends Tux and Stephanie from the Beyond Reproach podcast. I don't know if you remember, they did an episode on the Roosevelt, I believe, and on their website. What?
It's like we communicated without communicating.
Were you like, are you going to just copy and paste?
No. I listened to their episodes, re-listened to their episodes about the Roosevelts. Mm-hmm. I was going to give them a shout out because I re-listened to their episodes, and I even sent them Beyond Reproach a message this week saying, thank you so much for doing those episodes. They help so much with my own research.
Yeah.
So the fact that you're even bringing them up is just, it's amazing. That's all.
It's meant to be, man.
Yep.
But on their website, you can find an entire page dedicated to how the dry gin martini was connected to the Roosevelts and how to make it. In detail, because Tux does some really amazing research on his cocktails and presentation. My God. But I couldn't bring my pregnant ass to find a good non-alcoholic alternative because...
No explanation needed. The explanation is that you're pregnant.
Right.
And you can just stop there.
Yeah. But I do encourage you all to check out their website and their episode about this because it's really good.
For sure. It is. Yeah. It's very, very good.
So instead, today we're going to be drinking a spin on the Kentucky Cousin cocktail.
I love it.
Because one of the few fun tidbits I do actually know about these two is that they were indeed semi-distant cousins.
Yeah.
I also learned somewhere that Eleanor apparently was like obsessed with tea.
Oh.
So I just feel like this cocktail just works.
I really like that because something that we'll talk about a little in this episode is that she was like vehemently against alcohol.
Oh, yeah.
So I like that you brought in her taste for something that was non-alcoholic.
Yeah. Apparently she was all about tea time.
I love it.
Yeah. So the New York Kissing Cousins cocktail, as I like to call it, is made up of some sweet tea. An ounce of simple syrup, an ounce and a half of bourbon, or in our case, faux bourbon. Mint leaves that you're supposed to like muddle within all of that, and then topped with maraschino cherries. And can I just say, the amount of maraschino cherries that you gave to me was absolutely ridiculous.
Was
and
stupid.
Also, all of them are in my drink, and I will be consuming all of them.
I gave you like 20 of them.
No.
But it was like a dozen.
It's like six, okay. Unless Sam maybe ate some.
I definitely remember as I was like picking them out of the jar, like this is definitely too many.
This is ridiculous.
But is there such a thing as too many maraschino
There's
cherries?
There's six or seven cherries in this drink, and I will be eating them and drinking them all.
Oh, I can't wait.
All right. You ready?
Cheers. Ding, 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 ding. It's good. The only thing that would make this better is real bourbon.
Mm-hmm. You want to tell them about Alex?
I made my husband one of these alongside making myself one. Mine with faux bourbon, his with the real stuff. And he started dancing. He was like shimmying. And he said, he's a teacher. He said, this drink tastes like spring break, which as a teacher is his favorite time of year other than summer break.
Mm-hmm. It's good. Rating?
It's a 10 for me.
If it had real bourbon, it'd be like a 11.
Yes.
But without it, I have to say like 9. Yeah.
This is one that when you can drink again, we have to remake.
I will make. This is a drink I will actually make.
Have to. Okay. So I address this often when covering historical figures, but as most of you know, I generally always refer to historical figures by their last names. However, because the majority of the figures we will be discussing this week all have the same last name, that gets a bit confusing.
For sure.
So although it feels weird for me to do so, for consistency's sake, I will refer to all the figures mentioned in this week's episode by their first name.
I always feel weird when I do my episodes because I don't do that as much as you do.
I have honestly have never noticed. So it must just come very naturally and casually to you.
Yeah. I mean, I'm on a first name basis with all these fools. Let's be real.
I feel the exact opposite. I'm like, I will stumble to say Franklin because it's really difficult for me.
But you also need to like this one. It makes sense. So you have full permission.
Oh, well, thank you.
Yeah.
Something else I want to say up top, which is something I have also addressed many a time before, is that there is just so much information that we will not be able to touch on in this week's episode, or we would be here for as long as Franklin Roosevelt's presidency. Nerdy history joke, because yeah, he was the only president to be elected for 4 terms. Okay, y'all get it. Anyway, I just want to make it clear up top that this is not an episode about the early lives or backgrounds of Franklin or Eleanor Roosevelt. It is not about their many political and public accomplishments. It is not about the ways in which they quite literally changed history. Although the more I talk about what this episode is not, the more I want to do another episode about exactly all of those things.
Uh-huh.
Rather, this week is a very narrow and focused topic specific to Franklin and Eleanor's relationship with one another, as well as their possible, likely, romantic relationships with others.
Mm-hmm.
Now let's get into this cousins thing and get that out of the way first. All right.
Right.
It's not quite as salacious as I'm making it sound, but they were indeed related.
Fifth cousins, right?
Fifth cousins.
Yeah.
Once removed.
Removed too. All right.
It's kind of a mental block to understand, but I think the easiest way to explain it is that fifth cousins have the same great, great, great grandparents in common.
Yeah.
So Franklin would have been Eleanor's father's fifth cousin. According to genealogyexplained.com, quote, fifth cousins are related, but there is a chance they do not share DNA. In fact, there is only a 10 to 15% chance of sharing genetics with any fifth cousin, unquote. A 10 to 15% chance is still a little high for me.
Yeah, I don't like that.
I don't like that.
Especially
at all.
When there's so many other options.
In the early days, it's like there wasn't, though. It's like, oh yeah, you're the kid that I've seen at all my family parties all growing up. Let's get married. Franklin and Eleanor first met in 1866 when her parents went to visit Franklin's parents in Hyde Park, New York. When they met, he was 4 years old and she was 2. They would, kind of like I just said, see each other a handful of times over the years at family parties and whatnot. And in 1903, when Eleanor was only 19 years old, Franklin proposed to her. Franklin's mother, Sarah, was a nightmare, though. Like, seriously, talk about monster in-law, and strongly disapproved of the engagement.
Interesting.
Franklin was an only child / mama's boy. Just wait, we'll talk more about this later, and it will actually blow your mind. And she disapproved of any woman for her little boy, particularly Eleanor, who she did not feel was pretty enough or good enough for her son. His mom even went so far as to take her precious little boy away on a cruise to get him away from Eleanor in the hopes that he would change his mind about her. But he refused. He did concede, though, to his mother's request that the couple not announce their engagement for at least a year, and therefore the couple was not married until 2 years later on St. Patrick's Day in 1905.
Hey, 2 years at 19 years old, that a 2-year engagement is perfectly acceptable.
And perfectly healthy.
Yes.
To see if you'd like to change your mind.
Yes.
Eleanor, whose parents had passed away when she was young, was given away at the wedding by her uncle, Theodore Roosevelt.
Teddy,
who was actually serving as the nation's 26th president at the time. So that's pretty cool.
That is pretty cool.
You had the president walk you down the aisle.
Yeah.
You know what else is pretty cool? Not having to change your last name after you get married.
Oh my gosh. You know the predicament.
My God. It's a lot of work. Yeah. I have been married for almost 4 years now, and there are still some places that I have not changed my name because who has the time?
Yeah. And you're married to a man with one last name. Okay.
Oh, God. I can't even. Your predicament? I can't even.
When children are coming in too, man, are they going to be triple hyphenated? What's happening here?
And all those last names are like
ridiculous.
85 letters long.
Yes.
You know what is not cool, though? Enter Eleanor's monster-in-law, Franklin's mom, who was so obsessed with him that after he and Eleanor were married, she actually paid to have a townhouse built for the couple to move into, and then also paid for the townhouse directly next to it to be converted in such a way that there were passageways between rooms in the two houses, i.e., his mom didn't have to go ring the front doorbell in order to be admitted. Oh my God.
No.
No. Eleanor later stated that, quote, I did not like to live in a house which was not in any way mine, one that I had nothing about, and which did not represent the way I wanted to live, unquote.
And next door to a woman who clearly dislikes you and thinks her baby is the and stars yes. and moon. Like,
and I wouldn't even say next to you. She's in you. Yeah. She's in your house, which is her house.
Yes.
Of the six children she and Franklin would have, one of them would pass in infancy. Eleanor said, quote, "Franklin's children are more my mother-in-law's children than they were my own," unquote.
Yeah.
So that all sounds like a nightmare.
Absolutely.
I actually have a picture for us to look at that I have aptly titled Monster-in-Law. So let's check that out.
Okay. Oh, God.
Right?
Yeah.
Don't they all look so happy?
They look so happy together, all three of them. All three of them that are married to each other. But basically they're all three sitting in some wicker outdoor chairs looking absolutely perturbed to be in each other's presence. And the mother is giving side eye basically to Eleanor. Yes. Yeah. In the photo.
Yeah, in a photo.
Like, and you had to purposefully pose like that.
I'm reading into this too much, too, but it's like Franklin and his mom's chairs are way closer than his chair wife.
They look like the couple, and then Eleanor is like the awkward cousin. She's the fifth cousin.
She's the awkward fifth cousin.
Yeah.
Yes.
Wow.
Despite her overbearing monster-in-law, Eleanor and Franklin had a relatively normal marriage. That was until 1918. We'll back things up just a touch by going back to 1914. This was the year the First World War began, and Franklin was serving in the role as the Assistant Secretary of the Navy, which is the second ranking official in the entire Navy.
Wow.
Roosevelt was certainly a public and political figure at this point with a busy social calendar. Eleanor, though she supported her husband and his career, despised the life of a politician's wife.
Mm.
She hated making small talk. She hated attending parties. She was staunchly against drinking due to her own family's history of alcoholism, and so on and so on. I also don't think it helped that Eleanor did not have a whole lot of self-esteem. She referred to herself as an ugly duckling, likely fueled by comments her own mother had made about her plainness as a young child.
And then followed up by her mother-in-law.
Yes, yes. As a result, Eleanor actually hired a woman named Lucy Mercer to come work for her as her social secretary. Not only did Lucy assist Eleanor with preparing for all of the social obligations that came with her role as wife to the Assistant Secretary of the Navy, Eleanor actually had Lucy attend a number of events as Franklin's plus one so that she wouldn't have to.
I feel like that might have led to something.
My next line says, it probably goes without saying, that Franklin and Lucy would become romantically involved with one another.
Uh-huh. Didn't even see that line.
Didn't even have to. Historians believe this affair likely began in 1916 when Eleanor took the children to vacation at their home in Campobello Island as a way of getting out of the Washington, D.C. heat. Franklin, however, stayed behind on account of work obligations.
Yes.
But in 1918, when unpacking a suitcase of Franklin's, Eleanor discovered a handful of love letters between him and Lucy. We will never know the actual contents of the letters because Eleanor would have them destroyed, but whatever she did find in them absolutely destroyed her.
Aww.
She and Franklin weren't particularly romantic or intimate. In fact, she had revealed once that having sex with him was, quote, an ordeal to be born, unquote. Yikes. Yeah, I didn't say this in my research, but that quote that I just said about what having sex with him was like, mm-hmm. that was a quote that she shared with her daughter. So thank you, Mom, for telling me that. No one wants to know that.
God.
Yikes. Regardless of whether they were, you know, romantic or intimate with one another, she never expected him to cheat on her, much less with someone she trusted so deeply with the personal and private aspects of her life.
Yeah, that aspect of it has to be harder mm-hmm. than a lot. I mean, not harder, but another big blow.
When Eleanor confronted Franklin about the letters, he was truthful. He admitted that he was in love with Lucy, that this wasn't just some affair, this wasn't just for sex, but that he genuinely loved Lucy and was willing to risk what divorcing Eleanor might do to his political and social career if it meant being able to marry his true love.
See what looking outside of your family circle provides to you? True love.
It's outside you. Instead of inbreeding, you may find true love. And so again, despite what it might do to her own social life, Eleanor offered Franklin what he truly wanted, freedom. But Eleanor's monster-in-law would insert herself once again. Sarah was appalled at the idea of divorce. I liked the way an article for U.S. News titled FDR Secret Loves put it when they said, quote, adultery could be concealed, even tolerated, but divorce was a calamity,
which
unquote.
Is absolutely
insane.
The opposite of how I personally feel. I don't know about others, but
I would venture to say most people feel opposite to this. But if we think of the time period here, this is a decade or so later. JFK had women coming in and out of the White House, and that was not revealed.
Yeah,
like affairs were very, very common and kept very low key,
under wraps.
The paparazzi didn't expose those types of things.
Like
they
knew
they do now.
The paparazzi knew about it and still were like, out of respect or whatever, not posting about it.
Yes. Crazy. It's definitely a time period that we're looking at here. An affair committed by the male partner specifically was much more widely accepted than a divorce. Sarah told the couple that if they went through with a divorce, they would be cut off from her money.
I mean, he's running the flipping Navy at this point. Do they really need her money?
Yes.
Okay.
Yes. Sarah's the one that paid for the house they lived in, albeit a house that was connected to her own in which Eleanor did not feel comfortable.
Mm-hmm.
But she also helped them pay for medical bills for the children and helped them maintain the lifestyle that the old money Roosevelt family was used to, with housemaids and private schools and so on and so forth.
Okay.
So to say Franklin's not bringing in some money himself, sure he is, but they lived a lavish lifestyle. They're going on vacations every day, baby. They're every day they're going on vacation. And yeah, their kids are all in private schools and someone else cleans their house and does their yard and all of that.
Okay.
So could Franklin live without all of this? Ultimately, it would appear as though he could not. Franklin met with Lucy once more and lied to her, saying that he had proposed the idea of a divorce to Eleanor and that Eleanor had refused.
Okay.
Rather, he stated that he would have to meet Eleanor's demands, which were, one, he never see Lucy again.
Uh-huh.
And two, he and Eleanor were never to share a bed for the rest of their lives. Sounds kind of nice.
Especially if it's an ordeal. To
Eleanor's like, number one's negotiable. Number two, absolutely not. Unbeknownst to Eleanor for some time, Franklin had no intention of following through with the first demand, and he and Lucy would actually continue to be a part of each other's lives for the next 30 years, right up to the day that he died. In fact, it would be her, and not Eleanor, that would be at his side as he passed. But more on that later.
Honestly, like, this idea that, like, a divorce is worse than whatever, it's just, it's harmful to everyone. It's just so harmful to everyone.
It's so harmful. And especially in a case like this where, like, they both wanted it.
Mm-hmm.
They were on the same page. He was honest with her and was like, I'm in love with someone else. And she was like, cool, I don't like you anyway.
Yeah.
Like, but... but it was financial pressures, and it was societal pressures and political pressures. What would it have done? Not only to him financially, we've already discussed that, but politically, it would have hurt him too.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Up to this point, there had never been a divorced president.
Yeah.
Lucy Mercer would not be Franklin's only affair, allegedly.
Mm-hmm.
Lucy is certainly the most documented affair, and even those documents are scarce given that much of them were destroyed by Eleanor. But there is reason to believe that there may have been a few other romantic relations in the following years. The one other one that I would like to discuss, because she was the next most likely affair, was a woman named Missy LaHand. Missy served as a secretary for Franklin for more than 20 years. She really became a right-hand companion to him. She was there.
That's funny. Her name's LaHand.
Oh my God, I didn't make that connection.
She's
the
hand of the king.
She's his LaHand companion. Yes. She was there when he was diagnosed with polio and helped him with his treatment and physical therapy. She adopted a lot of his same interests, such as poker and stamp collecting and drinking, all things that they did together often. The only actual documented evidence of the affair, though, is in a book Franklin and Eleanor's son wrote in 1973, in which he stated, quote, "Everyone in the close-knit inner circle of father's friends accepted it as a matter of course. I remember being only mildly stirred to see him with Missy on his lap as he sat in his wicker chair in the main stateroom, holding her in his sun-browned arms. He made no attempt to conceal his feelings about Missy," unquote. And although she did not specifically state that she was referring to Missy, Eleanor even wrote later, quote, "You must learn to allow someone else to meet the needs of someone whom I dearly love without bitterness or envy and accept it," unquote.
That's big of you.
I think it's big of her, but I also think Eleanor, she didn't specifically state that she was speaking of Missy, but it's widely believed that she had accepted that someone else would fulfill the needs of Franklin, that she was unable to meet herself. She didn't want to.
Yeah.
I don't think that's too much of a stretch, but I do think it's fair to say, like, it can't be just anyone. It can't be the woman that you broke my heart with.
Yeah.
Like that's not okay.
Yeah.
This lady that I actually really like, sure.
Mm-hmm.
Eleanor was kind to Missy, treating her as, quote, an elder daughter, unquote. She took her shopping and even attended her mother's funeral. Whether Missy and Franklin were ever able to consummate this relationship is debated, given that he was struck with paralyzing polio in 1921, something that we have discussed in more detail in our episode 94 about hidden presidential illnesses.
Mm-hmm.
What we can confidently state is that she meant a whole hell of a lot to Franklin, considering the fact that he would later rewrite his will to leave her $3 million upon his passing.
Excuse me?
But it wasn't a romantic relationship, right?
Right.
Sadly, Missy suffered a number of strokes and or heart attacks. That's what they were said to be during that time period. But I think they're more modernly believed to be like mental breakdowns or panic attacks.
Oh, okay.
And in June of 1941, she would collapse while at a party at the White House. A month later, she would pass away at the age of 47. Historians continue to debate to this day whether she and Franklin did indeed have a romantic relationship. There are no documents or records indicating as such, but many close to the Roosevelts, including their own son, believe it was pretty damn obvious that there was more than a friendship or professional relationship there.
Yeah.
I mean, I've never left $3 million to
a friend.
Well, really anyone.
Yeah. But,
but definitely not someone I'm not in love with.
This episode was brought to you by Audible. Audible is the leading provider in spoken word entertainment and audiobooks. They have titles ranging from news, self-development, business, fiction, and more. Not only do they have audiobooks, but they also have podcasts, wellness guidance programs, and more. The best thing about Audible is that you can download titles to listen to offline, anytime, anywhere, across all devices without losing your spot. And Audible has thousands of titles for you to choose from. Maybe pick one of my most recent favorites titled The Betrayal of Anne Frank, a cold case investigation written by Rosemary Sullivan. If you would like to try out a free 30-day trial, you can do that right now using our link at www.audibletrial.com/#history. That's www.audibletrial.com/#history.
As we previously discussed, Eleanor was beside herself in the aftermath of the Lucy Mercer affair. This is where we really saw a break in the Roosevelt marriage, with Franklin becoming more involved in politics and other women, and Eleanor becoming more involved in activism, social work, and other women.
Ooh.
Maybe. While alongside Franklin, who was campaigning for the presidency, Eleanor met in 1932 a reporter for the Associated Press named Lorena Hickok, or as she was known by all those around her, Hick. Lorena was an extremely accomplished journalist. In fact, she was the first woman to have a byline on the front page of the New York Times.
Go Hick.
I know. It's pretty amazing, her accomplishments. She was also pretty ahead of her time as an openly gay woman. As a woman, she had to work hard AF to get to the professional level of success that she reached. And so when she was given the assignment of interviewing Eleanor Roosevelt, this like presidential nominee's wife, she was actually kind of upset. She was afraid covering a story like this would throw her back onto the women's page of the newspaper.
Mm.
It wasn't long after actually meeting Eleanor that Lorena realized, quote, she's a person, unquote. I love that. I love that she instantly recognized there's actually some depth to this person. She's not like all the other first ladies in the past. And that's not to degrade them, but they were of a generation where all first ladies did was appear at events and look pretty, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Eleanor Roosevelt was not that. And Lorena Hickok picked up on that right away.
Hmm.
The two became fast friends and would remain friends for the rest of Eleanor's life. In fact, for a period of time, they would see each other every single day. The two were always together for dinners at the White House, out on the town at the theater, and even traveling together for months on end.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. At a certain point, Lorena realized that she could no longer write objectively about the Roosevelts, given how close she had become to them. So she left her job with the Associated Press and instead began working as an investigator and researcher for Franklin's New Deal initiative.
Interesting.
So quick history 101, because we don't have the time today, but hopefully one day in the future. FDR's New Deal was a series of government-funded programs established at Franklin's directive during his presidency to help get the country out of the Great Depression. So these are programs that included things like, you know, emergency relief, bank reform, unions, and included the creation of organizations such as Social Security Administration and the Farm Security Administration.
This is totally random, but wasn't the Hoover Dam part of the
New
Deal?
Yes, it was.
Yeah, okay.
Yes, it was.
Okay. I know things.
Mm-hmm. Well, everybody knows that, right? I don't know. I have no gauge for these things.
I know.
It was important to Franklin and Eleanor as well, that these New Deal programs were successful and running well. However, given that they were based in D.C. and these programs were being operated across the nation, it was difficult for them to receive firsthand accounts of each program's success. Enter Lorena. Lorena traveled the nation, reporting back to the Roosevelts about the programs. This traveling caused Lorena and Eleanor to be apart often, though, so they would write one another letters. Apparently, Eleanor wrote 10 to 15 page letters to Lorena daily, sometimes even twice a day.
I know they did not have as much to do at this time period. So like writing letters was like entertainment for them, but my God.
But my God. I try to equate it to like sending you a million text messages and I still don't think I could get there.
I don't think you could either.
10 to 15 page letters daily. Twice.
Jeez.
Daily. The two became so close that Lorena actually lived in the White House off and on for a handful of years. So were the two actually romantic with one another? The majority of historians believe so. Before she passed, Lorena would lend the FDR library 18 boxes worth of letters between her and Eleanor. Apparently, the two exchanged more than 3,000 letters over the course of their relationship. 2,336 of them survived because Lorena allegedly burned some of the more scandalous ones.
Mm-hmm.
When these letters were discovered in 1978, the contents led many to believe that the relationship between Eleanor and Lorena had gone much deeper than just friendship. An article I found in my research, and will of course link in our website under our citations, pooled together 24 of the quote, very gay excerpts, unquote, within these letters. And I want to read off a few of them to get your thoughts.
I knew about all this, but I don't know like this level of detail, and I'm excited to hear some of them.
It's going to make you feel warm and fuzzy.
Oh, okay. Yeah.
The first, this is from a letter from Eleanor to Lorena in March of 1933, reads, quote, Hick, my dearest, I cannot go to bed tonight without a word to you. I felt as little as though a part of me was leaving tonight. You have grown so much to be a part of my life that it is empty without you, even though I'm busy every minute, unquote. I chose this quote in particular because that one line, empty without you, would actually inspire one of the most comprehensive books about the letters between Eleanor and Lorena, titled Empty Without You, The Intimate Letters of Eleanor Roosevelt and Lorena Hickok. Mm-hmm. I definitely recommend checking that out if you want to really dive in to more than I'm able to cover in this week's episode. Mm. It was revealed in these letters that Eleanor and Lorena had a little saying that they shared with one another. I'm hoping you can help me out with this one, Leah.
Je t'aime et j'adore. Je t'adore. It basically means I love you, I adore you.
Exactly. They used to say this back and forth to one another. And in this one letter in particular, Eleanor states that she's upset that there were witnesses around. And so she felt that she was unable to say the phrase to Lorena over the phone. And so I think that definitely goes beyond just like, as a friend, I love you. If you feel uncomfortable saying it with other people around you.
Yeah, exactly.
In another letter, also from March of 1933, Eleanor tells Lorena, quote, "My pictures are nearly all up, and I have you in my sitting room where I can look at you most of my waking hours. I can't kiss you, so I kiss your picture goodnight and good morning."
Okay, unquote. Yeah. If anybody needs proof, there you go. I mean, like, the other ones were all proof, but, like, yeah. Okay.
We're going to get deeper and deeper into it. There's going to be, if you thought that was proof, just you wait.
Okay.
In a letter written in November of that same year, Eleanor tells Lorena, quote, "I'm getting so hungry to see you," unquote. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. The following month, Lorena wrote to Eleanor saying, quote, "Only 8 more days, 24 hours from now, it will only be 7 more, just a week. I've been trying today to bring back your face, to remember just how you look. Funny how even the dearest face will fade away in time. Most clearly, I remember your eyes with a kind of teasing smile in them and the feeling of that soft spot just northeast of the corner of your mouth against my lips," unquote. Mm. Another letter in April of 1934 from Eleanor to Lorena said, quote, "Dearest, I miss you and wish you were here. I want to put my arms around you and feel yours around me. More love than I can express in a letter is flying on waves of thoughts to you," unquote.
These are just so sweet.
I would say I feel warm but cold at the same time because I have goosebumps now. I believe these two letters in particular imply that there was a physical romantic relationship between the two.
Yeah.
In February of 1934, Eleanor wrote to Lorena and said, quote, "Hick, darling, I just talked to you, darling. It was so good to hear your voice. If I just could take you in my arms. Dear, I often feel rebellious too, and yet I know we get more joy when we are together than we would if we had lived apart in the same city and could only meet for short periods now and then. Someday, perhaps, fate will be kind and let us arrange a life more to our liking. For the time being, we are lucky to have what we have," unquote. I think this letter implies that Eleanor longed to have a true, genuine, and public relationship with Lorena, but she and Lorena both knew this just simply wasn't in the cards for them. Lorena said to Eleanor in a letter dated October of 1941, quote, "I meant what I said in the wire I sent you today. I grow prouder of you each year. I know no other woman who would learn to do many things after 50 and to do them so well as you, love. You are so better than you realize, my dear. A happy birthday, dear, and you are still the person I love more than anyone in the world," unquote. Mm-hmm. Lorena was incredibly encouraging of Eleanor and was actually the major motivator behind Eleanor beginning her own newspaper column titled My Day, in which she recapped her daily activities 6 days a week for nearly 30 years. I could literally go on forever. I mean, there are almost 3,000 of these things. But from these historical records, many historians have discerned that there was indeed a romantic relationship, though it's not for sure proven that it was a physical one.
Okay. All right.
I appreciate the squint in your eyes. This is definitely one of those things that for like a long time historians were like, they were really good friends.
Yes. Yeah. That's like, that reminds me of when I was doing those TikTok trends. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And there was one where it was like historians being like, and the feeling they were feeling was friendship.
Exactly. That's exactly what historians said for a very long time. And in fact, not only historians, but also even Eleanor's own children don't agree that there was a romantic relationship between their mom and Lorena. They say that Eleanor was a very affectionate person just in general, and that it was not unlike her to say to her friends that she loved them and wanted to hug and kiss them.
Those letters, I don't know. I can tell a difference mm-hmm. between me telling you that I love mm-hmm. you mm-hmm. and telling my husband. There's a difference. Yes.
There's a difference. And I can even say, like, saying to you, like, oh my God, I can't wait to see your face.
Yeah.
And also saying, like, oh my God, I can't wait to hug and kiss you. I don't know anything about soft spots on the corner
exactly.
of your lips.
Yeah. Those are very intimate details.
That goes a step beyond just saying, I can't wait to hug and kiss you.
Mm-hmm.
I have hugged and kissed you, and I know
the soft spot on the side of your face. Yeah.
Yes. I do think it's worth noting, though, that Eleanor was friends with several openly gay women and also even had other rumored affairs with men. So that all kind of throws a hole in, did she and Lorena have a romantic relationship or not?
Okay.
Over time, the two would transition from this more impassioned relationship into a friendship. The shy and introverted person Eleanor had been when she and Lorena had first met was no more. Eleanor had really grown into her own in her position as First Lady, getting involved in social work and advocacy and writing. Lorena would actually grow to become jealous and upset at the lack of time that Eleanor had for her as the years went on. Lorena, who was diabetic, would experience a number of health issues in her later years, which included arthritis, making it especially difficult for her to return to work as a writer. Having given up her profession as a journalist due to her close relationship with the Roosevelts, Lorena floundered for a while as she attempted to find work. She would work for a short period of time as a public relations and marketing person for the 1939 New York World's Fair, and later she would become the executive secretary of the women's division of the Democratic National Committee, a job she got because of Eleanor's connections. Eleanor would pass in 1962 at the age of 78 from cardiac failure. Being the private and more introverted person that she was, Eleanor, of course, desired a small and simple funeral. But of course, no can do here. It was a giant affair. But of all the people to attend her funeral, Lorena did not.
Oh.
She instead visited Eleanor's gravesite at midnight to have a private, intimate moment with her alone. As for Lorena, she would pass in 1968 while living in a cottage on the Roosevelt Estate. She would end up being placed in an unmarked grave, her remains having not been claimed.
Oh.
I know, isn't that awful?
That's really sad.
This would be the case until 2000, when her grave was finally given a marker, which read, quote, an AP reporter, author, activist, and friend of ER, unquote.
Friend.
As for Franklin, he would pass in 1945, just a few short months after the inauguration of his fourth term as president. He suffered a stroke while on vacation in Warm Springs, Georgia, with none other than a Ms. Lucy Mercer, now Lucy Rutherford. As I alluded to earlier in the episode, Franklin and Lucy never ended their relationship, and after her husband passed, she would begin seeing Franklin more and more, with private White House diaries mentioning her by a code name when she would come to visit the president. It wouldn't be until his passing that Eleanor learned that he had been with Lucy on his final day and many, many days before that. There's so much more I would have loved to discuss. Eleanor's activism, Franklin's presidency. There really is so much more that we could have gone into here.
Mm-hmm.
But again, I tried to keep it narrow and focused and juicy.
Juicy.
What are your thoughts?
I just feel sad for kind of everyone involved.
Yeah.
That they couldn't be with the people that they actually wanted to be with.
Yeah, I completely agree.
It's just sad.
It is sad. And I don't know, maybe have we reached a time period where people can be with the people they love? I would say more often now than they used to.
But also, like, politicians?
Yeah.
I don't know. Just because you're under such scrutiny of everybody, right?
Mm-hmm.
And you need to, I don't know, toe a line, an invisible, ridiculous line, you know?
Yeah, I think this episode is very reflective of both the past and, unfortunately, also the present.
Yeah.
Thank you all so much for listening to this episode of Hashtag History.
We will share the picture, that lovely picture
that
we discussed. Yeah, the monster-in-law that we discussed on this episode to our Instagram. And all sources used to put together the episode will be found on our website at hashtaghistory-pod.com.
Subscribe to us on whatever podcast platform you use. Share about us with your family and friends. And then give us a rate and review.
Be sure to check us out on Instagram. We are at hashtag history_podcast.
And come join us over on Patreon, where for as little as $1 a month, you can help support our books and booze supply. You also get access to some behind-the-scenes content, an automatic 15% off all merchandise, and we mail you cards and stickers.
Oh my gosh. And now... Now we'd like to announce our season finale guest.
We are so thrilled to share that we have the wonderful Amber Hunt joining us once again for next week's finale episode.
Amber actually joined us to close out our season 9, in which she discussed the Osage murders, which was eye-opening.
It was eye-opening, and I have been, should I say surprised? I don't know. To see that that is actually one of our most popular episodes yet.
And I wouldn't be surprised if it's not because of, but adding to that is because of the Leonardo DiCaprio movie that came out a year ago. So it's very topical. If anybody is interested in that movie, I think it's, what is it?
Killers of the Flower Moon,
which is about the same thing.
It is. Yeah. That was definitely a very illuminating episode. Amber was wonderful. I'm so glad that we had her on the podcast. I know that you all really liked her because, like I said, it's one of our most popular episodes yet. So I hope that you all will be so excited about having her back on the podcast next week. She will be talking with us all about her new book titled Crimes of the Centuries, in which she discusses lessons learned from the Salem witch trials, the Radium Girls' fight for workplace safety, the legacy of the Scottsboro Boys, and more, which, I mean, those are topics we are not interested at all.
No, it's not like we've already done our own episodes on some of that.
Literally all of our own episodes. So I think you all will enjoy that very much. I'm super excited to have her on. And thank you once again for listening to this episode.
Awesome.
Thanks.
Thanks. Bye.
Bye. I thought you were trying to make, when you started laughing, I was like, did I say like an unintended sexual joke?
No, sorry. I'm just being stupid.
It's perfect.